You're listening to the Tipsy Nerds Book Club Podcast, your home for the best of science fiction and fantasy, with a twist. Whether you prefer your stories with dragons or aliens, your beverages shaken or stirred, fill your glass, relax, and join the conversation with your hosts, sci-fi and fantasy authors and proud Tipsy Nerds, Natalie Wright and R.S. Dabney.
Welcome, Tipsy Nerds, book lovers, sci-fi and fantasy fans, and dreamers, to the Tipsy Nerds Book Club Podcast. I am sci-fi and fantasy author Natalie Wright, and with me, as always, my good friend, sci-fi and fantasy author, the intrepid Robin Dabney.
Hi, Natalie. Great to be here with you for season. I've already had a little of my drink for episode three or two, depending if we count the Lord of the Rings. Yeah, I think three. We'll call it episode three, season four.
We don't know where we are. We don't know what day it is. We don't know the time. And we don't know what episode we're talking about. But we're here.
And we know the book.
We do know the book. We do know the book. The book we're talking about today is a graphic novel, The Sandman. And we're covering just the first really like collection, which is Preludes and Nocturnes, written by Neil Gaiman, illustrated by Sam Keith, Mike Dringenberg, Malcolm Jones III, and various colorists, cover artists, and letterers. But we're also going to talk about the 2022 Netflix series by the same name that was developed by Neil Gaiman along with David Goyer and Alan Heinberg, starring various people we'll talk about in a moment. And we watched that, and it's, yeah, we'll talk about how they're related or not. I also want to mention that the original comic series was published by DC Comics. I believe the first issue was copyright 1988. So it's been a while to get that from a graphic novel all the way to a production on the streaming service. But so we'll probably be going back and forth and talking about both.
And I read that this one, I probably like screwed these numbers up, but I read that Nocturnes and Preludes, the one that we are reading and discussing for this, was the first of 10 graphic novels in this series, but one of 75 for all the spinoffs and content related to the series. So it's a huge world. And I also wanted to add the show I read covers this Preludes and Nocturnes, and also then the second issue in this graphic novel series. So it covers one and two.
All right. Very good. I'm excited about the drink that I'm drinking. We've been kind of lax in our drinks a little bit, but you know, we're trying. I am drinking a drink that I'm calling Dream of the Endless. And if you know the series, you know why. It's a frothy, kind of milky concoction. It looks like a nice glass of milk that you're drinking before bed, but the alcohol in it is absent. So it's going to kick milk. You on your ass. It's also got egg whites and cream, and then it's like an almond syrup that you can get online if you're looking for that. It's really a frothy, creamy, milky, tasty, something that in Italy you might drink for breakfast.
It sounds very fitting to the story because it's also a bit chaotic, yeah. But in a way that like fits together, and it's I'm intrigued. I like it. And of course, I love that name. Good name for a drink.
Yeah. And what are you drinking, Robin?
So I'm drinking one I'm calling 24 Hours, which Ooh. Is one of the chapters in the graphic novel that's probably the weirdest or super fucked up. And in the series too.
Spoiler, my favorite chapter.
Yeah. In the series too, it's you're sort of like, what is happening? Anyway, it takes place over 24 hours in a diner. It's crazy. And so in this cocktail, I have coffee, of course, got to stay up 24 hours. I have tequila, of course, got to be crazy. And then it's topped with whipped cream and some cinnamon. So we kind of both went with that creamy thing. So for the, that felt sort of like the cream and cinnamon felt sort of like the dream. Right. The tequila felt like the chaos.
Right.
And the coffee felt like staying up all night, and it embodied the craziness. So yeah, 24 hours is this cocktail.
I'm going to drink that too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I was a little like skeptical at first because I thought tequila and coffee would be disgusting, but it's not so bad.
I think tequila goes with everything.
Mm-hmm. I It does.
So I was a Sandman virgin when I watched the series. I actually watched the series first because it came out. My husband and I watched it on TV. So, and then I read The Preludes and Nocturnes. So for any of you out there who don't know anything about the story, let me just do a little setup here. So the main character is Morpheus, aka Dream. He is one of the seven endless. They are basically personifications of things like there's death, and he is the lord of the dream world. So he is in this story captured by these people doing some kind of an occult ritual. They're actually trying to capture death. And this is set in 1916 when this happens, but they accidentally get Dream, and he is imprisoned by them for 106 years. And they take he's got these objects of power, which is a pretty popular trope in fantasy literature. So he's got a helm, and he's got a ruby, and he's got a little bag of dream dust, I guess. And
sand.
And these things are taken. And in this first series, really, it's all about him trying to get those things back because they're part of his power. And he's put himself into them, and until he has them back, he's not at his full power. So it's a quest, basically. It's a quest story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the basic setup, the basic premise. It's fairly simple in terms of, you know, the main plot.
And through his quest, he's running into the fact that in the 100 years he was imprisoned, the dreaming, which is the world, the dream realm that he was king of, and the waking world have all sort of like fallen apart because of his absence. And so he's also running into the effects of his absence. And I was also a virgin to this story, and I started reading the graphic novel first, and I was like, what is going on? I don't know anything. It moves so quickly. It's chaotic. It's like, I'm not saying it was bad. I just was like, so, and then I paused the reading. I watched the first series and went back to the reading. And even though there were differences, I was able to enjoy the graphic novel more because I kind of had a basis in what was happening. So if anybody is like not already in the graphic novel world, if this isn't kind of your normal medium and you do want to dive into these, try reading it first. But if you need to watch the show beforehand, I think that's also okay in this case. It was for me.
Right. You know, I heard about a study years back about like if you didn't grow up reading comic books or graphic novels, it's kind of like a skill that your brain doesn't like do because you have to match words and pictures together to create the story and the way that they move. And in this graphic novel, sometimes you're moving across the top of the page, left to right, all the way across. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're moving the panels go on the left side down, and then you go over to the right and go down. So it is sometimes a little bit difficult to follow especially if you're not used to reading, things like this,
right?
Like a picture book, the story all happens, you know, it's like a picture and a story on the page and then the next page. But comic books, you can get like this, it's almost like immersive.
Yeah. And it's just dialogue mostly or thought. There's no description. So that's the other difference. And I think that was a big piece is my brain wasn't trained for that. And also this may be me, but I feel like the first two chapters of this book were a little fast and disjointed more. So I felt like as I kept reading, either my brain clicked with the process of reading a graphic novel or it was clearer. And as I'm saying this, probably the writer and editor did a good job of making it flow. So I think it was probably my brain.
I don't know. I guess, you know, we can kind of get into, you know, thoughts about it and what's going on.
I just want to ask you the big, broad question.
Yeah.
Did you like this?
I'm finding it difficult to answer because I would say it's a qualified yes. You know, so the very first reading comic books. So I am a comic book fan and I'm a fan of comic book art and writing. And it's obviously very different from, you know, novels and literary writing without pictures, but I like them both. And when we read The Watchmen, that was the first graphic novel I had ever read. And I loved it. It was a little hard for me to get into, but I loved it. And I felt like I was like, holy shit, where has this been all my life? Mm-hmm. And I became an immediate fan of that. This one, not so much. And part of it, I think, is that actually in the afterword written by Neil Gaiman, that a few years after the original came out, he said, I don't feel like I really hit my stride. I don't feel like I really found my voice until the very last chapter of this Preludes and Nocturnes, which is a chapter called, I think, the Feel of Her Wings.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In which we are first introduced to his sister, Death, his older, mm-hmm. wiser sister, the one who they were trying to capture and they didn't. And I agree with him 100%.
Maybe, and that's what I was feeling. Yeah. It's like, I actually felt as it went along, it became more and more interesting and cohesive and I could follow it. And the stories felt fuller, not just like a smattering of details that you're supposed to sort of keep track of.
Exactly. And I felt like both in the graphic novel and in the series on Netflix, and the series on Netflix, I was bored out of my skull for about the first 4 or 5 episodes. The pacing was so freaking slow. I was like, seriously, you could have shoved all this together. I felt like they maybe in hindsight were trying to follow the graphic novel very strictly so mm-hmm. that each episode was like matching to an episode in the graphic novel.
I think
but
they were.
The problem is there wasn't enough material there. And so it was mm-hmm. just like, these big, dark, like sets with no detail. You know what I mean? Then it switched because at, I think around the time of 24 hours, which I think is just like on the show, that was where I started to become a fan of the show, was 24 yeah. hours. Mm-hmm. And it really shifted something for me. And mm-hmm. the same happened in the graphic novel. That's where but it's almost the end.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, okay. So by the end, I was like, oh, there is something here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something here. And in terms of Gaiman's writing, it starts to feel like that lyrical, almost poetic, observational style that he can, when he's at his best, he's mm-hmm. got. Mm-hmm. And I started to really then, if that makes sense, that's a long answer.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think I totally get it.
Mm-hmm. I didn't like it. And then I like was, eh. And then I did like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say I don't love it.
Okay.
I think if I had gotten a hold of Sandman when I was 14, 13, 14, I would have devoured it.
Okay.
Yeah. But in terms of its place in the world, I feel like now so much more has come out since then that I'm not mm-hmm. sure that I personally would go invest a shit ton of time to learn more mm-hmm. about this realm.
Okay.
In terms of the writing, when there's other stuff that's probably a little bit more developed and,
mm-hmm.
but I appreciated by the end, I did appreciate why it had become a phenomenon. I could see it. And I was like, okay, I get it now.
Yeah. I think that makes sense.
That's my very long answer. How about you? What were your thoughts overall?
When I started, I said, I read the first 2 chapters of the graphic novel. And I was like, I think I need to take some acid or something. Like, not in the mind. Like, I don't have the capacity to do this. And then I switched to the series. And it's funny. I actually loved the whole series. And I totally understand what you're saying. Somehow, I felt like every episode was also sort of different, even in the way it was shot, in the different stuff. I felt like this was all just some chaotic trip. And I've never really seen anything like that. That was like some of it was tied together. I really enjoyed the story that then didn't have anything to do with anything else of the mortal who he and Death decided to make immortal. And the Sandman
really like
eats him every 100 years to talk about what happens. And so you see what happens from, I don't know, like 1400s to the present day and how this man has changed. And it was a very simple and quiet episode, but I loved that. But then you mm-hmm. had 24 hours, which was sheer violent, brutal, twisted chaos. And I also loved that. And then when I went back and read the book, I did like the book. I like the changes they made for show. So like in 24 hours, even for example, in the book, the let's say the antagonist is just sort of crazy and bad and has no real motivation. He just is sort of in the show, they actually give this guy like a trauma from his past. It's totally believable what he's doing. And he's not a megalomaniac. He's coming from this place of like pain and trauma. And And he, in his mind, is saving the world. Whereas in the comic, he's out to destroy it. And I loved the show's version of 24 Hours. I did like the book too, because it was the pictures, everything was just awesome to look at and read. But I loved that change that they made. And I also, and this is a personal thing, I love that they took out all the DC references in the show.
I agree.
Because I felt like it was so cheesy when he's like, I gotta go find Batman or whatever. And you're just like,
right.
What?
Right.
And again, that may come from me not being so deep into this world, but I felt like anytime they referenced the Justice League, I sort of rolled my eyes because I was like, this makes it seem cheesy or commercial. And I like that the show left out pretty much, I guess, every reference to that. But
yeah, and Neil's afterword that I was referencing earlier that he wrote in 91, mm-hmm. he agrees with you. He said that he thought that wasn't a very successful thing, but it was like, this is his first time writing a comic and he was trying things out. And some of them worked better than others. And so,
and judging Neil Gaiman based on like 1988, 89 Neil Gaiman, right? Versus I'm reading it right now and I'm like, oh, he can do better. It's give the man a break. Like,
right. Well, he did do better because then he helped develop the television series. And I do think that some of the rough spots in the graphic novel are smoothed over, and there's more backstory, there's more motivation for characters, there's more depth. Now I don't know, because I haven't read all the rest of the graphic novels in this series, but Lucienne is the librarian of the dreaming, and I love that character in the show. She did a great job with that character, and in the graphic novel The Preludes and Nocturnes, it's just like just a few panels we get Lucienne. You hardly see this character. So, and then the two brothers, Cain and Abel, also in, you get them in the graphic novel, but then in the series, there's a lot more to them. They're more integral to the story. So a lot of
you understand the feels and motivations. And I think, I always think every time I watch something now and there's like a lack of motivation or I read something, I'm like, Natalie would have a problem with this. and I'm like watching the show and, you know, Cain and Abel follow these stories of basically Cain and Abel, the first murder and the first victim or whatever. And so in this dream, Cain keeps killing his brother Abel, and Abel keeps every once in a while digging himself out of the grave. And then he's like, you know, it's not Cain's fault. This is who he is. And it's not so bad being murdered. And it was just, he was like, you know, this is what older brothers do. And it was comical and whimsical in the way that, like, you know, in that Neil Gaiman, Terry Pratchett way. And it didn't come across so much in the graphic novel, just because there wasn't the space to do that. And so I loved those little.
I think the thing, the graphic novel, though, actually might have done better with that story is actually the horror of it.
That's true.
the despair of that character where, in the show, they did this a little bit, but in the graphic novel, you get that that's just the way he is. But isn't that awful? Because all he wants is his brother to love him.
Yeah.
And it's like, wouldn't it be nice if I wake up and he's nice to me one day?
Yeah.
And it also is like, oh, that is, some people are in those kind of relationships, you know? So anyway, I do think there are times when you read Neil's words in the graphic novel that, I don't know, I feel like Neil at his best has a poetic lyricism that with very few words, he can pull out a feeling. And there are a few moments here where you see that. And yes, it's his early writing, so probably not seeing it as much. Like, I tried 3 times to read American Gods, which is a tome by him, but I couldn't get into it. And I was like, oh, maybe I just don't like Neil Gaiman. But I feel like he's at his best when he writes things like The Graveyard Book, Coraline, where he's got fewer, it's almost like he doesn't know how to use more words. I shouldn't say he doesn't, but it's like he's pumping it up with more words, but not necessarily more substance.
And when his gift is the story and the lyrical whimsy and the dark. Yeah, I see. If he stayed in the thing that was his actual baby, like the thing that he actually does better than everybody else, instead of trying to do the things other people do, maybe.
Right. I feel like he has this like poignancy to his writing where one minute you're seeing something like, you know, whimsical, but then the next moment he turns it. And this is where I'm saying, I do see him in conversation with David Mitchell, who we just recently mm-hmm. talked about with Slade House. They're both British authors. You see them coming from a similar mold, and they both have really great strengths. But I think David Mitchell has the ability to flesh the story out more mm-hmm. With more words. Whereas Neil, I feel like he's at his best when I'm getting that mm-hmm. more spare writing where he's touching on just a few words, but he's really pushing an emotion toward you.
Yeah.
That hits the feels and it's like, oh, that's kind of out of left field. Wow. Now. And like the horror aspect, it's like he's trying to be creepy, but it's like, it's not really creepy. It's just like kind of weird and gross to me. That's to me.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily feel like those parts were as successful because mm-hmm. it's like more like stereotyping of what creepy would be rather than actually.
Yeah. Creepy. I think so. It almost was like some pieces felt like they were there for the shock value rather than to prove something or say something. One thing I think he did really well throughout this and even in the writing of this first book, but also in the show, I think it's really evident, is the, like, and this ties back to what you just said with Cain and Abel, is like almost every piece of this is interwoven with this like idea or theme of like a prisoner and needing to find freedom of something, whether it's like physical. I mean, it opens with Morpheus being like stuck in a cage for 100 years and then needing to break free,
right.
Or Abel being stuck in this perpetual cycle of being murdered, or John Burgess, who has been put in a mental hospital because, you know, his mother has a bit like, and he just wants to be free. And, you know, the muse at the end, Calliope again is held prisoner and just wants to be free. I feel like all of the, like, it's such a like strong theme throughout, and like every detail and character he added is in some sort of like struggle for that.
Right. Or and even the people who are sleeping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something we haven't talked about. That's a kind of a big piece of this, where when he's imprisoned, there are people who are asleep and can't wake up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they're imprisoned as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the woman, drawing a blank on her name, Constantine, who had his sand, you know, she's stuck with this nightmare and she can't get out of this nightmare. And, you know, things then happen with that. And, or the woman who had the sand and is stuck in these wonderful dreams, but is wasting away and dying. And so it's, I felt like that was so cool when I sat back, especially as a writer, and was like, wow, he really put that same concept almost like in your face on the nose, but in a nice way that I felt like was really well done. And
right.
Yeah. I appreciated the strong use of theme in this story.
Right. It must have been too on the nose because I didn't get it. Okay. Maybe I'm just dense. I'm like, la, la, la. I'm like, look at the pretty art. Yay.
Yeah. No. It's not dense.
It didn't really, like, I guess, occur to me.
I think we've all been in those places where we feel like trapped and you're just like, I need to get out of this space. And I felt that through the story. And I was just like, this is well done.
Right.
I
felt that in the live action adaptation that the gentleman who played Morpheus and Sturridge. I thought that he did a really good job. I liked his portrayal. At mm-hmm. first, I felt like, again, this first couple episodes, I was like, is this kind of flat?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's Dream. That's Morpheus. And like when you mm-hmm. read the graphic novel, it's like he is pretty flat.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
And a bit dense
Like not, he's not super emotive, you know, mm-hmm. and he's not human.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But as the live action series went on, I felt that, and it's again, that tone kind of fit with the graphic novels where he's being shown as a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
more humanity is coming out of him.
Yeah.
And I thought that the actor did a really good job with that.
Yeah. And I really loved his voice. I felt like that was such a, whatever an endless should sound like, I felt like I could totally buy into the fact that this guy was like Lord of Dreams because his voice was just so phenomenal. And I'm over in Germany and my partner pulled up the preview on YouTube to watch it. And it, like, the guy starts speaking in German and I was like, nope, stop. You must, because it was like higher pitched and fast. And I was like, nobody should watch this show out of the original version of English just because Tom Sturgis, Sturridge. His voice, Sturridge, I think is just the perfect Morpheus voice, and nobody else should ever make that different.
So I have a question for you, if you know this, and if you don't, listeners, mm-hmm. do you know the Raven, Matthew, mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. is not in Preludes and Nocturnes, mm-hmm. so, but he's in the live action, voiced by Patton Oswalt, mm-hmm. who has an appropriately annoying voice for this character. Like, it's, you know,
yeah.
mm-hmm. not a calm, beautiful, soothing voice like Tom Sturridge. What did you think of that character? And I want to know, is this a character mm-hmm. that appears later in a Sandman series? Or is this a character that was created solely for the live action?
Interesting.
But, yeah.
So I can answer one. I don't know if he was created for the show. I know like Corinthian, who is a major character in this, doesn't show up till like issue 11 or something of the Sandman. So they did add some characters in that will come later. Yeah. So maybe he does. As far as what I thought about him, let's see, from like an archetypical standpoint, he sort of acted as like the guide or what, the sidekick, or, you know, because he does serve a role.
Definitely a sidekick, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. Companion.
An unwanted companion. I mean, Morpheus keeps going, why are you here? Get out.
I wasn't mad at him or about him. I love personified animals, I guess would say. I like that he was there to help. I liked that when I saw him show up in situations where I thought like bad things were going to happen to somebody good, and he like flops, like flies in there, and I know like Morpheus is watching and he's there and maybe things are going to be okay. So he did provide a little bit of like calmness for me when I didn't know if somebody was about to have their eyes stabbed out, you know. It's like so, you know, for me, for my anxiety, I don't know, he was a nice addition, but right. Yeah. What did you think?
Yeah, I was just unsure about how I felt about the character because I watched it before I read it. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, okay, is this the ubiquitous cute animal character? Mm-hmm. And then when I read the graphic novel, he's not in it. So I felt like, oh yeah, I felt like it was kind of an add-on, and it was kind of an add-on, which was, but I see what you're saying. And I felt that. Again, he kind of grew on me, though. I mean, as it went on. There are so many great characters. I would say that's another strength of Neil Gaiman. And then along with the artists. But although I do think that the live action adaptation just modernizes all of the way that the characters are drawn and their casting. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed the art of the live act. I enjoyed both pieces of art, right? The mm-hmm. illustrations. Mm-hmm. But the sets and the production and the design of the mm-hmm. show, there was mm-hmm. a lot to love about that from my point of view. I mean, it was just, some of the scenes were so beautiful. Some of them, you know, they really captured the darkness when they need to be dark.
I heard HBO turned this down because it was going to be too expensive to produce. So that's how you know it was well, well made.
Yeah. I can't think of the name of the character right now, but there's that one character she was someone who I think was a nightmare, or there was something going on with her. And then she was visiting the little boy.
Galt.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that character and the way
and that arc.
They did it and the arc, and it was all very cool.
Yep.
So yeah, lots of love about the artistry of the show, I think.
And I think they did a good job too of, I think one of the other big themes that, well, I felt that I read was also like the like accepting change a bit. So I feel like Morpheus comes out and like a lot of the show in the first book is like him sort of like really grasping on to what was and fighting against like what was. And I think that's even evident with Galt, the character you just talked about, who was created as a nightmare. And he's like, you know, I don't want to give her story away because it's super cool. But it's like he's like, this is how you were created. This is what you're going to do. He's very resistant to change, or even when he meets with his sister Death in that episode and chapter, which was one of my favorites. I actually cried in it in the show. Yeah. I felt like it was really emotional. And she comes upon him and he's sort of like moping and like, I don't know what to do with my life. And she's just like, you know, get over it. Quit being a baby. Like find something new. You're the Lord of Dreams. And I think that was... Yeah, I liked that theme of it too. It was this, sort of this, like, you either learn to let go from a trauma or a grief, whether you've been imprisoned by humans for 100 years, and I don't mean to downplay the severity of that, or whether your mother locked you in a mental institution, also don't want to downplay the severity of that. But it's, I felt like there's a nice theme in here of, if you don't learn to cope with trauma and grief and to change and adapt, then it will kind of destroy you and take you down a dark path and maybe repeat cycles, or you'll just spin in this darkness. I felt like there was a couple instances of that in the show that, I don't know, perhaps I've just been in dark places over the last few years of my life, but I really felt like this had a lot of things that spoke to me in certain ways.
I think another interesting thing about that very episode you're talking about, it's called The Sound of Her Wings, where he's meeting with his sister Death, and you really see, like, on screen, and then when you're reading the graphic novel, you see it in the words and in the illustrations, this shift in Morpheus. But when you take that in conjunction with the afterword written by Neil Gaiman, it also is sort of emblematic of the actual writing of the story. Mm-hmm. Neil says, "Here I am. I've never written a comic book before. I want to. I got this thrown in my lap, and I'm like, shit, now I've got to actually do it, and produce this." And he said, he was like, one episode is like this, and one episode is like that. And he's reaching for tropes or for ideas of other things that have existed before. Mm-hmm. And that it's not till The Sound of Her Wings that he is kind of released into his own creativity. And so it's interesting that the way you said that, because I thought, well, that's kind of what he's saying. He's like,
interesting.
And then also I saw a critique by a woman who wrote for the Hollywood Reporter that was saying that for this being about a place of ultimate creativity, right, where you can dream anything you want, it kind of feels a little bit like not very creative. And I thought, well, that's interesting too, because in a way, again, getting back to Neil talking about, well, I was doing like a DC comic in one, and one episode I'm doing like, you know, he's trying to like kind of mimic or copy other known works.
Yeah.
And it is, in a way, like the basic story up to the point of 24 hours is like a very tropey sort of like quest story. It's like, now Harry Potter comes after this, where we have, which is kind of interesting too, when you think about it, because in 1989, Neil Gaiman is writing about a character who has ultimate power, putting a piece of himself into these objects. Mm-hmm. And then a piece of him is now, this power is in these objects. And then, you know, he's got a quest to get them back. Well, later when Harry Potter's written, you know, the Horcruxes, it's a very similar kind of idea. But I don't know what I'm trying to say, but like, when you get back to the main story, you know, the quest story where someone's got to go get their objects, it's like, you know, every video game, every D&D campaign, you know, it's like, it's very like done. Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's all very questy. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of following that. And it's not that it's bad, but it doesn't really start to sing until he releases that kind of like, you know, this has been done for 1,000 years kind of way to write a story. And then it starts to feel a lot more creative. 24 hours is like,
yeah,
I mean that, and then it's like, boom, he got it out of his system. Now he's on, right. So I don't know, maybe I would want to read more of these, because I would like to see if that continues and he really releases himself out into the.
I need to read the afterword. I finished today, so I didn't finish the afterword piece, but I love that also, because I can see that what you just said, him sort of in the same journey as Morpheus as he's writing this, and then sitting on the park bench, throwing bread to pigeons, being like, oh my God, this is just trivial, derivative, rote. And then he's like, somebody who knows who came along, probably Terry Pratchett came along and said, you know, what are you doing? Why are you feeling sorry for yourself? And then he like snapped out of it and wrote 24 hours. That's how I imagine it now.
Yeah.
Definitely Terry Pratchett.
What's really interesting too is like, no matter how successful a writer is, because by the time Neil wrote 24 Hours and The Sound of Her Wings, I mean, this was already a phenomenon that was taking off. If I understand it correctly, it sort of like took off right away, and people were enamored with it. And they were enamored with the stuff that he's then reflecting on, saying, oh, that was, I mean, here, I should read some of this afterward. I'll tell you what exactly what he was said. He said there was a definite effort in the past in the stories of the Bone to explore genres available. The Sleep of the Just was intended to be classic English horror. Mm-hmm. Imperfect Host plays with some of the conventions of the old DC horror. Dream a Little Dream of Me is slightly more contemporary British horror. And A Hope in Hell harkens back to the kind of fantasy found in passing. And he says, rereading these stories today, I must confess, I find many of them awkward and ungainly.
Interesting.
Although even the clumsiest of them has something, a phrase perhaps, or an idea or an image I'm still proud of.
Yeah.
But where the story starts and the seeds of much of what was to come after were sown in the tales of the book. So I thought, yeah, I just read that. I thought that was really interesting because mm-hmm. I think that he nails his own, he's critiquing mm-hmm. himself, but in a way that I really agreed with, which was that yeah. like, this feels like that, that feels like that. And then finally yeah. he releases it all and he's, mm-hmm. he's finding his voice. And as a writer, that's what happens. I mean, my, yeah. you know, my first works are very derivative and really mm-hmm. reacting to the world. And it takes a while to find how, what you want to talk about and how you want to say it and all of that. But it doesn't
and learning
matter.
How to string phrases together. That's what, yeah. as you were reading that, I was like, huh, I could use that for my own first story that, you know, I can still look at and be totally proud of because, oh my God, I did that. And that was an important stepping stone in getting better. And so right. it's, you know, I think it's great that he's able to look at that and say that. And he should absolutely still feel proud of it because it's still, we can judge and critique it. It's still such a cool thing. And how else do you get to the point where you have that aha moment if not slogging through the derivative swamp? You know, I think, yeah.
I also like that he doesn't crap on the people who liked it, right? It's mm-hmm. as an author, you can look at your own work and say, wow, I can do better. It doesn't mean that people didn't like it mm-hmm. and get something out of it. So right. I like that he, and I think that's one of the reasons why Neil has continued to have such a great fan base, because he really does, I think, appreciate his fans in a way that a lot of really super famous authors don't.
Yeah.
And he, like here, he's being respectful of the fact that people could get something out of this, mm-hmm. even if he's later reflecting it wasn't the best thing he ever wrote, in yeah. his opinion, based on right. what he's doing later. So
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah. Did you know he played the voice of the Raven in the last episode where the cat was having the dream and there's like a raven in a skull? And I remember being like, I think that's Neil Gaiman because I did his master class. I took his master class
too.
And I was like, I know that voice. And so then of course I get on IMDb and sure enough, Neil Gaiman voiced the Raven in the cartoon cat dream, A Dream of a Thousand Cats or whatever. So just not sure if anybody noticed that, but if you're a Neil fan, he was in it.
Once they were, you know, those like extras sort of in the season of the live action and the, yeah. the one you were talking about, the animated one. Mm-hmm. I love those. I thought yeah. those were so, so well done and very cool mm-hmm. short stories. And the one with Calliope,
yeah,
I was like,
too.
Oh, that was really,
I was like, that was one, this doesn't always happen, but sometimes where I was like, I want that idea. Like, why wasn't yeah. that my idea? And I felt that with the Calliope one. I thought that is a cool story, but
yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I have not been the biggest Neil Gaiman fan, and I've often been like, I don't get it. Like, why, what? I just like, And I would say that after reading this and also watching the series, I come away with a new appreciation of Neil's writing and his skill, his vast reservoir of ideas and ability to put together things. Known things like he's taking Lucifer, which we didn't mm-hmm. talk about, also mm-hmm. a really great portrayal of that in the live action, you know, dream and death. And he's taking all of these archetypes and
yeah.
the mythologies, which I'm always really into, and putting them together in a soup that yeah. comes out feeling different. And I would say I come away with a bigger appreciation of Neil's writing and his skill and ability from this series.
Cool.
So I would say I'm not an uber fan of Neil's. Like, I don't feel the need to like chase down every single thing that he's ever written, but I'm now more of like, okay, I understand why he's gotten the fan base that he got.
Well, that's actually a very glowing endorsement from you.
Is it?
Yeah. Coming for Neil Gaiman, because I know he's not your most favorite. And so for you to be like, I don't dislike him now, and he's got some merit, I think people should know that that's a big compliment.
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, there are times when, I mean, there are books that we actually start that we don't talk about on the show because we really don't mm-hmm. want to talk about things that we really dislike. You know, yeah. I don't want to crap on someone else's work because sometimes it really is, you know, a preference. Like yeah. there's writers whose voice and writing I just can't get into. And it, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't matter if 4 billion people like it. I'm not yeah. the one.
And we don't want to crap on any of our listeners who may like certain stories.
Exactly. Because it's like,
again, preference.
So what do you think, Robin? Overall, what do you, your last thoughts about this?
Yeah. So I would definitely recommend watching the series to anybody who is even remotely interested in, you know, the science fiction fantasy genre, because it's well made, it's well acted, it's nice to look at. Know that it, you know, there's some things that are like soft and quiet and gentle and bring you to tears, and things that make you have to cover your eyes and stop eating spaghetti. It's like, just be aware that it's a roller coaster, but in a really cool way. And I, you know, I would recommend the graphic novel to people who like graphic novels and haven't read it, or who maybe want to just see what it's about. I would say if you're new and you're actually kind of interested in getting in, I would recommend Watchmen more, because that one I felt like was easier to follow. But this does have nice images. Again, the story does pick up, and there are a lot of merits to it. I just, you know, just go in knowing it's a little tough at times, especially in the beginning, at least for me. But all around, I would absolutely recommend the story as a whole and the content as a whole, whatever your medium is, to enjoy it.
I enjoyed this story world and what was being built more than I enjoyed Neverwhere.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In terms of Neil's work. So I'm glad that we did this, because it gave me a little bit more perspective on Neil Gaiman than Neverwhere.
And we'd like to ask you listeners too, how did you enjoy The Sandman, either the graphic novel or the show or both? And how do those compare to other Neil Gaiman works to you? Do you also feel, do you love everything Neil Gaiman, or do you feel like he has a sweet spot? We'd love to hear your thoughts on all of these. And you can, you know, message us wherever, Instagram, Twitter, unless it dies.
Facebook. As we record this. Yeah, there is the legit question whether Twitter will implode or not, or what the fudge is happening with that. So,
but wherever you can find us, let us know your thoughts.
We're around, and we always love to hear from you all and see what you're thinking about. Next episode, we are going to be talking about a story I can't wait to dig into. It's a story by one of my favorite people, Robin Dabney.
Oh, hello.
Yeah. So that will be, we're sticking with our theme of December being creepy for fantasy nerds.
It's a very creepy story. We'll have more information on it closer to its release date, but it's a story called The Utbird, which is a horror Finnish folktale retelling, and it's in an anthology by Quill and Crow Publishing called Bleak Midwinter, The Darkest Night. So stay tuned for information on that, but I can't wait to talk to you guys about this creepy little story.
I am really looking forward to reading that whole anthology. Every teaser that the publisher puts out, I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
Like those all sound really fun to curl up with on a cold day and read. So looking forward to that. I guess that's it. Mic drop. No. Craig, be merry.
I was sitting there, I need to say something. I need to follow this up and say something. And then I just totally blanked.
Well, you know, you have
my second. This is the tequila coffee 24 hours. When you see the episode, you'll understand. I second everything Natalie said. We're thankful for all of you who keep tuning in and listening to us babble for 4 seasons. And hopefully you stick with us. We're really grateful that you know, we would do this anyway, because we love talking to each other, but it's so much more fun having you guys along too. So thank you. And until next time, cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Tipsy Nerds Book Club podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, and share the fun with your friends and family. Want a recipe for a cocktail you heard here? You can find recipes as well as show notes, episode transcripts, and helpful links on our website, tipsynerdsbookclub.com. And as always, join us next week for a new episode of Libations and Geeking Out. Cheers.